Shrink Wrap Radio number 647, The Unspeakable Mind of PTSD, with Shelley Jane, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Shelley Jane, MD, Stanford psychiatrist and author of the 2019 book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Dr. Jane specializes in PTSD and serves as the medical director for integrated care at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. For more information about Shelley Jane, MD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.com, a leading online therapy site. Now, here is the interview. Dr. Shelley Jane, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Well, I feel very honored to meet you and to provide the opportunity for you to speak about your work and your remarkable book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD. So to get us started here, I'm interested in the title. Why did you call the book The Unspeakable Mind? What about PTSD is unspeakable?
So often, you know, experiencing a trauma, it often represents a violation, you know, of everything that we hold to be dear and sacred. And a lot of times such events, they just simply become they're too terrible to utter aloud.
Yes.
And they take on this unspeakable quality. And, you know, as you know, sometimes the survivor wants to speak up. But if the wider community is unwilling or unable to bear witness to their story, then the survivor is forced into silence. So then the trauma becomes unspeakable that way. The problem is we know that PTSD thrives under such conditions. You know, when these traumatic thoughts and memories, if they remain unspeakable or unthinkable for too long, they actually impede our brain's natural process of recovery after trauma. You know, they become these stuck points that inhibit the mental reintegration that is really needed for healing to occur. So, you know, in my mind, really the unspeakability of the trauma was at the crux of the PTSD.
Interesting. And what I get maybe implied in what you just said is that if a person can speak very soon after the trauma, that perhaps it doesn't become PTSD? Is that too strong a statement?
Well, I mean, I think you're onto something there. You know, I definitely feel, you know, we know that giving people support in the immediate aftermath of the trauma, and part of that support is, you know, hearing them and providing that kind of psychological safe space. We know that that can actually prevent the onset of PTSD. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I do feel like if a survivor is ready to speak, being there and allowing them to speak can be hugely beneficial,
okay,
as opposed to, you know, creating an environment where they might be hindered in some way in that regard.
Yes, yes. And I think often we feel, those of us who are not the traumatized person, sometimes feel shy about pushing a person to talk about something that is so terrible and feel like, well, you know, I don't want to re-traumatize this person or make it worse by trying to, you know, interview them about what just happened.
Well, so to be clear, you know, we never want to coerce people into talking. We don't never want to make them feel like they must talk when they're not ready to. Mm-hmm. That we know does not work.
Okay.
You know, they tried that with critical incident stress debriefing back in the 80s, and that does not work, and it may actually harm.
Okay.
But there is that fine line, though, right, between creating an environment where the person can talk, and also us as the people who are bearing witness, us being able to hear it, the story. Sometimes we want to avoid it. Sometimes we don't want to accept what happened. So there's that fine line, right? Never want to coerce, never want to force people before they're ready. But when they're ready, we should be ready to receive the story.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good reminder. Also, the subtitle of your book speaks of the front line of PTSD science. Mm-hmm. And that sounds exciting, the front line. Perhaps you can expand on that a bit for us.
So, you know, I'm a psychiatrist by training, and I was in private practice up until 2007. And then I decided at that point, for various kind of personal, you know, revelations, that I'd been a clinician up to that point. All my training had been to be a clinician. And that's still to this day the place where I feel most comfortable. Uh-huh. But I decided in 2007 that I wanted to learn how to be a researcher, because I was growing dissatisfied with not having objectivity to know that what I was providing my patients was really happening, you know?
Yes. Yeah, was it really helping them? Yeah.
Yes. So I left private practice, and for 2.5 years, I was a fellow at the National Center for PTSD in Menlo Park, and I was also a postdoctoral scholar at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Yeah. And in essence, in those 2.5 years, I really learned how to do health services research, specifically with regards to post-traumatic stress disorder. And ever since then, that's where I kind of live. I provide PTSD care to veterans as part of the VA hospital in Palo Alto. So even clinically, I feel like the VA is really on the cutting edge of what's going on in PTSD, because obviously part of their mission statement is to really take PTSD seriously. And then also I continue to do my research in affiliation with the National Center for PTSD. So I'm really blessed that I'm part of this brain trust of people who have committed their lives to understanding post-traumatic stress disorder and the science of PTSD and advancing the clinical practice of PTSD. And so really, I feel like that's where I speak from when I wrote the book, that kind of vantage point of having the benefit of being part of that brain trust and having, you know, taken that time to become a researcher and a scientist myself.
Yeah, yeah. What a special position you're able to occupy. And how nice to be able to refer to oneself as part of a brain trust. I don't think I can do that. But, you know, I've been, you know, I interview a lot of people. And one of the things I've noticed lately is that there are two topics that are very prominent right now. And one is mindfulness, and the other is PTSD.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And in some cases, I guess they go together. But there's an enormous amount of therapies that seem to be springing up in which people are claiming to have good success with PTSD. And now, one of the things that you talk about, and this could be related to what I was just saying, is that one of the dynamics you write about is overdiagnosis and under-recognition. Maybe you can expand on those a little bit for us.
So, you know, I feel like since 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Hurricane Katrina, I do feel like, you know, PTSD has become part and parcel of our modern vernacular, you know?
Yes, yes.
But part of the reason I wrote the book was because I also feel like it's become sloppily invoked. I think it's misunderstood. I think it's misconstrued. And part of what I wanted to do was really get precise about what we mean about PTSD. Yeah. Because in my experience, if we get flabby in the way we use it, it really diminishes the science and the practice.
Well, I've wondered about that because I've had guests who make the point or attempt to make the point that we all suffer from PTSD. And I've been concerned, well, isn't that overgeneralizing the term? Just what you just said, losing some of its valuable specificity.
Right. And I would argue the opposite. You know, I think trauma exposure is very common in our society and around the world. So the odds of you being exposed to a major traumatic event are very high, something like 60% of men in their lifetime, 50% of women in their lifetime. But you have to remember that the percentage of people who will develop PTSD as a result is is a small percentage. It's a substantial percentage, but a small percentage. It's something like 8 to 10%. But the problem is because the rates of trauma exposure are so high to begin with, even that small percentage translates to a lot of people. So, you know, at any given time in America, there's 6 million people who have PTSD with active symptoms that need treating. So, you know, it's a considerable problem as it is. And sometimes I think people conflate trauma exposure with PTSD. They think trauma exposure equals PTSD, and that is just not the case.
Okay, maybe I just committed that error in stating, and quoting what other people have told me. And maybe they weren't telling me that we all suffer from PTSD, but rather that we all have been exposed to trauma and to different degrees bear some effects from that.
Yes, that I would agree with. And, you know, in recent years, we've come to know of this sub-syndrome, which is called partial PTSD, where people do not meet the criteria for full-blown textbook PTSD, but nonetheless they're suffering, they have more subtle symptoms, and they would probably benefit from some type of professional attention. So I think if you add the numbers of people who have partial PTSD to the 6 million active sufferers at any given moment in time, that's a lot of people. You know, and the odds are, you know, someone in your life who has that or is suffering, just the statistical odds from that many people. You know, if you're fortunate yourself not to have it yourself, someone you know probably has it.
Yeah, maybe that's the basis for something that you say in your book, that PTSD is an inextricable part of all of our lives.
Yes, That's definitely a point that I wanted to make. You know, we tend to think of PTSD, the obvious image that comes to mind is the soldier back from war.
Yes.
But really, if you look at the statistics, PTSD can result from many traumas, you know, rape, family violence, being robbed at gunpoint, escaping a natural disaster like a fire. You know, so many things can lead to PTSD. And if you look at the stats, well, actually, it's all of our business. You know, because you promise. So speaking to your question that you asked me before about overdiagnosis and underdiagnosis, it's both. It's probably overdiagnosed now because of some of the reasons we just touched on. There's a conflation between trauma exposure and PTSD. But the sad thing is, it's also underdiagnosed. The reality is PTSD hits hardest those who are socially and economically disadvantaged in our community. And those people are hard to reach for many, many reasons, and they're not getting diagnosed.
Yes.
So it's both. It's both at the same time. It's probably overdiagnosed in some, underdiagnosed in others.
What is the impact of trauma and or PTSD on the quality of life?
I think it has a huge impact on quality of life. I think it interferes with the way we love, the way we create, the way we work, the way we play. It really hits every dimension. So let's take just your personal life, for example. You know, trauma is infectious. Trauma begets trauma. The odds are that if you love someone who has PTSD, you are yourself at higher risk of PTSD, depression, or anxiety yourself. You know, so if you get a sense of that, how it infiltrates our society, I mean, that's pretty alarming. So you just look at the personal lives of people with PTSD. They're much more likely to be divorced, have a lot of problems with intimacy emotionally as well as sexual intimacy in interpersonal relationships, much more likely to have violence in a home where one of the sufferers has PTSD. You know, so you can start to get a sense, a lot of lost productivity in terms of employment for people who have PTSD. You know, those are just some of the ways. And then now, of course, in recent years, we've got to have a sense of the toll having PTSD takes on the physical body. So the relationship to things like obesity and heart disease and cancer. So, you know, it really seeps beyond the confines of mind and brain, and it infiltrates into cells and organs and bodily systems. So, you know, these are just some of the ways it impacts quality of life, not to mention the higher risk of death by suicide, not to mention issues with violence, those are just some of the ways.
Yeah. At first, it sounds extreme to say that it's infectious, but, you know, with the examples that you're giving, clearly there's a kind of social contagion, if you will. And as you point out, it can impact the environment that one is in, whether it's the family or a social group or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it raises the question, too, I mean, since we're going that far, the impact, you know, on the family and so on, and also, as you just suggested, the impact on one's health, can we say that it's genetically transmitted at all? Is there a predisposition towards PTSD that can be inherited?
So that is something that has become quite apparent in the last decade or so. You know, when you think of PTSD, you know, you think of this external traumatic event, you know, and your first instinct is, well, what has that got to do with genetics? But research has shown that PTSD is actually highly heritable. So, you know, as I was talking about earlier, you know, trauma exposure is really common, but only a small minority will develop PTSD. Now, genetic factors probably accounts for 1/3 of the overall risk of developing PTSD.
Well, that's a high percentage.
Yes. So, you know, when you look at that group who develop PTSD after trauma exposure and the group who don't, genetics plays a big role in determining, you know, who does. And so in that way, it is actually a very heritable condition. Now, there is this other form of science called epigenetics, which is a little bit different. But again, it's very fascinating. It's still early days. We still don't really fully understand the epigenetics of PTSD. But there's enough that we should be able to be aware that, you know, when a man or a woman is exposed to a major psychological trauma, you know, it's damaging psychological trauma, it can impact the man's sperm. It can impact the woman's eggs. Huh. And then these changes are transmitted to their future children via this process of intergenerational transmission. And this leaves their subsequent children vulnerable via altered neurons, neuroanatomy, and genes. And so you can see how the children of these traumatized parents can be at risk, even though the child themselves may never have been exposed to a traumatic event.
Wow.
But, you know, but then if in their life that child is exposed to a traumatic event, well, they're going to respond from that position, you know, of carrying those sorrows in their genes. So they're going to respond from that vantage point. So in my mind, you know, when you think of mass traumatization, you know, when you think of slavery and genocide and, you know, atrocities that affect mass people.
Yes.
You know, we start to get this sense of PTSD's deep footprint.
Yeah, wow. It paints a pretty bleak picture, bleak sounding picture. I'm thinking of dominoes, you know, in a row, and once one domino gets tripped, they all start falling down. And so it sounds like there's that sort of an effect going on here with multiple factors that can be involved in the tripping of the dominoes. And what's the impact on the brain specifically?
So we know the neurobiology of PTSD has been pretty well developed in the last 20 years or so. You know, I don't think, you know, as you know, neurobiology is constantly advancing, right? As the tools that we have to probe the brain and its circuitry improve, then the landscape is going to shift too. So, you know, I hate to be very definitive when it comes to neurobiology because I know I'm going to have to eat my words.
Okay, I won't make you do that.
But here's what we know. At this moment in time, this is what we know, that in the PTSD brain, there's probably three regions that are implicated. The hippocampus is one, you know, and as you know, the hippocampus is the part of the brain where long-term memories are stored.
Yes.
And we know that for some reason, the hippocampus is smaller in people who have PTSD. We don't know what direction that relationship is in, though. We don't know if they were just born with a smaller hippocampus and that made them vulnerable to developing PTSD, or the PTSD somehow made their hippocampus shrink. Yes. You know, so we don't know the directionality of it, but we do know the hippocampus is probably somehow implicated. The other parts of the brain that are implicated, the amygdala, of course, that part of our brain that processes fear and anger, that is overactive in people who have PTSD. They tend to sense danger even when danger is not there. Mm-hmm. And when they react, that reaction is more pronounced too. So yes. It takes a lot of time for them to calm back down to baseline.
Yeah.
And then along with this overactive amygdala, there is a frontal lobe, you know, which is involved in our planning and our execution and our impulse control and judgment, that is inactive.
Yeah.
You know, less active than it should be.
Right.
So, you know, you combine the inactive frontal lobe with the overactive amygdala, you know, and then problems with memories, and then you start to get a sense of what's going on in the PTSD brain. And then obviously from a neurochemical standpoint, you know, noradrenaline, adrenaline, that is present in higher levels in people who have PTSD. There's probably some serotonergic dysfunction as well that accounts for the anger and the irritability associated with PTSD and the mood states. And then the stress hormone, the human stress hormone cortisol is also implicated in some way. We're just starting to get an inkling of what that picture's like. But that's some of the kind of neurobiological aspects that we know to be true at this point in time.
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful picture. You just, you know, very, with great economy, you just kind of sketched out for us. Let me break in here for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp.com, an online counseling and therapy site. Is there something interfering with your happiness or that's preventing you from achieving your goals? You know, I'm reluctant to promote anything I haven't had some experience with. They've given me a free 3-month subscription so that I could kick the tires, so to speak, and tell you how it's going. I recently had my third video therapy session with my BetterHelp.com therapist, Marjorie Fagan. She's such a good listener that I feel treasured. My mood has been lifted after each of our sessions. So I feel confident in asserting that BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not be locally available in many areas. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, just as I've done. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. My own experience underscores that BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches so that they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. Visit BetterHelp.com/shrink and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. For Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/shrink. Now, back to the interview. As a clinician and you're diagnosing people, of course, you're not going to be doing testing their brain and so on. Mm-hmm. What are the symptoms that are displayed that tell you, oh, this is PTSD?
So that's a really good question, because it can sometimes be hard to, you know, tease out PTSD from, say, you know, a mood disorder or, you know, anxiety.
Right.
So in my mind, you know, 8 times out of 10, there's a clear trauma history. You know, there's a clear, okay, something happened and there was a before and an after. And after that, I wasn't quite the same. You know,
yes.
So sometimes there's not a trauma history that is the patient is consciously aware of. Sometimes it takes time for that to come out. But you know, 8 times out of 10, I would say they're pretty clear that, you know, I was fine before this and then I was not fine.
Yeah.
So that's one thing you want to be listening out for. And then I think the hallmark features of PTSD that really helps us differentiate it from other diagnoses are the intrusive symptoms, you know? So that's the nightmares, the flashbacks, the intrusive memories, which are very trauma specific. So it's not just general nightmares, it's nightmares related to the trauma. You know, it's flashbacks, which is a reliving of the trauma in the present. You know, it's intrusive memories of the trauma. And again, this sense of reliving in the present, those are some of the hallmark features of PTSD. And then along with that, the kind of hypervigilance and the startle reactions, you know, the overreacting, the flying off the handle, you know, the road rage or the, you know, or going from 0 to 10 in terms of anger with no control, that kind of, you know, hypervigilant, hyperstartle reaction, those are very, in my mind, very typical for PTSD. And then, of course, there's other symptoms too. There's the avoidance cluster, you know, there's mood states, you know, I think shame, guilt, are very predominant in PTSD, you know, more so than in other conditions. So, you know, there's other moods, there's all the symptom clusters too, but I think some of the ones I've mentioned are kind of the hallmark features that you can help tease it out from other mental health conditions, which is hard because PTSD rarely lives alone. It often goes hand in hand with depression or addiction and anxiety. So teasing it out can be tricky.
Yeah, thank you. You know, as a result of the wars that we've been engaged in and some of the recent weather traumas and so on, how has the science changed? What's changed in the science of PTSD in the last, say, 20 years?
Well, a lot has changed, and I think there's many reasons for us to be hopeful. You know, I don't mean to paint a dismal picture in terms of the statistics and whatnot. I feel like this is a really exciting times in terms of PTSD science. You know, the events that you mentioned fueled a massive body of research. You know, people really started to get behind PTSD and accept that it was a condition. And that has really helped advance our understanding of the condition because we've had so much research. And this is a body of research that continues to grow exponentially. So that's really good news. And the really the exciting news is that PTSD was once considered incurable and disabling, but today it's very treatable and manageable. So we have a lot of well tried and tested treatments that we know work for PTSD.
Well, I was just going to remark it's really accelerated our understanding of the brain and other systems. From a scientific point of view.
Yes, I think absolutely. I think there's so much, and different types of science, not just neurobiological science, but health services research, epidemiological research, pharmacological research. So I think the whole mental health community benefits when there's this much high quality research done.
Right.
So, I feel like there's a lot of exciting advancements in the science, in the treatment, and then we've done a lot of work in understanding how to prevent PTSD, which in my mind is the really exciting piece. And that's where I feel we need a paradigm shift. We need to stop thinking about prevention, you know, as opposed to treatment.
I want to come back to that. But before we go there, I wanted to ask you, what's at the cutting edge of treatment today?
So I feel like in terms of talk therapies now, you know, it's just become clear there's such a robust evidence base to support many treatments as being the kind of first-line treatments. And oftentimes first-line treatments are talk therapies, which are trauma-focused. So they involve a kind of reworking of the trauma and really helping the patient understand their trauma cues and really working through the trauma so that the trauma literally does not have that power anymore to hijack their brains and their bodies. So, you know, treatments like EMDR, which has been around for a really long time, but I feel like the evidence to support it as a cognitive behavioral therapy treatment for PTSD is sufficiently robust. And then things like prolonged exposure or cognitive processing therapy, those are the treatments that we know we have great evidence for their effectiveness. Now, just because a treatment's effective, obviously, doesn't mean it works for everybody.
Right.
And there are additional treatments that are not, you know, for many people, understandably, the idea of working through their trauma is just really daunting. And what we've needed and we have now available are treatments that don't really go back to the heart of the trauma, but focus instead on the here and now. You know, so what is going on in your life because of the trauma that is disrupting your life today, and what can we do about it?
Uh-huh.
So there's a treatment called STAIR, STAIR. There's a treatment called ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And they help people with PTSD, but like I say, by focusing more on the here and now. So if someone says to me, you know, my interpersonal relationships are a mess, you know, I can't hold down a relationship because I just get very agitated and I can't trust people. They focus on that, and they focus on arming the patient with the skills to help them get through the day to day.
Yeah.
So that has been a really exciting development as well. And then there's a lot of cutting edge innovation going on, maybe treatments that aren't quite ready for prime time because we don't have that robust data to support their effectiveness. But there's no doubt they hold a lot of appeal. So, you know, if you think of like art therapy programs and you think about, mind-body approaches like meditation, yoga, acupuncture, neurofeedback, really popular approaches.
Right.
You know, which I believe are being more extensively investigated, but are used widely by patients who have PTSD.
Yeah. I've got some of those I wanted to run through with you a little bit. And you've mentioned some already, like EMDR. And and there are all these sort of spinoffs from EMDR that involve tapping, you know. And so I don't know if we yet fully understand the underlying neural mechanism of, you know, why does this work? Why does it work to tap on acupuncture points on your body, or to you know, something about people have talked about bilateral stimulation of the brain, and I suppose distraction is another thing that people have talked about. Do you have any sort of personal sense of, you know, why do they work?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. And I, like you said, in terms of the neural mechanisms, I think we're still far off. I think there's some studies done with the talk therapies that have looked at changes that occur in the brain after going through some of these talk therapies. And there have been some preliminary studies that suggest changes in the neurobiology that explain how the therapies are working. But I don't understand. With a lot of the mind-body approaches, I don't think we have a clear understanding of exactly what it's doing. Now, this is where I come back to being a clinician, and I'm a very practical person. And you know what? If in a controlled trial you can show me that someone feels better and their scores go down and they have a better sense of well-being and their quality of life is improved, you know, I'll take it.
You're all for it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, the brain is an exquisitely complicated and intricate organ, and I think it's going to take us decades to really unravel what's going on, is my feeling, you know? And we have people who need help right now.
Yeah.
So whatever we can do is helpful. So what I like to look for is those nice randomized controlled trials, multi-site trials, data from different sources. That helps me be confident in recommending something for a patient. But at the same time, I know that what is tried and tested doesn't necessarily work for everyone. So I have to have this open mind, you know.
Yeah, right.
If someone tells me that, you know, a dog therapy program changed their life, well, then, you know what, getting a, you know, emotional support animal, that's fine with me. But really my job is to kind of make sure that they've tried the tried and tested. And if that has failed, then we will try, you know, then we'll be open-minded. But really, I like to see that people have tried what is tried and trusted first.
I was at the gym this morning, and a guy that I'm friendly with at the gym said that he had just seen something on, you know, he asked me what I'm doing, and do I have any good guests coming up, and so I mentioned that I was going to be talking to you and about PTSD. And he said he had seen something on 60 Minutes that sounded very interesting. So just before this interview, because I initially showed up an hour too early. So I put that hour to good use. I went down and was able to find it on the television. Uh-huh. And I don't know if you saw it, something called stellate ganglion block.
Block, yeah.
SGB. Uh-huh. And they mentioned that it's in trials right now. It's very preliminary. They said it's only being offered in 12 VAs. Is it offered in yours by any chance?
Not that I know of, but it's interesting you mention that because a couple people have told me about that. I haven't had a chance to look up the segment yet.
It's last week's episode of 60 Minutes.
Okay. Yeah, no, I look forward to watching that. But I talk about SGB in the book. So there was a big, big fuss made about SGB a few years ago. Everybody was swearing that this was going to save everybody with PTSD, this kind of rapid cure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I had a flurry of patients come to me asking for that treatment. At that time, it was attracting a lot of media attention because I believe, because of this promise that it literally cures people, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of painless kind of magic bullet, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think it attracted a lot of media attention and people were coming. But if you actually look at the data at that time, it was experimental, as you say,
right.
you know, it was preliminary. It was pilot. It was anecdotal. And then there were a couple studies done with this. There's also a cervical block, CSB, which is kind of a related kind of premise and treatment. Then when the subsequent studies were done, it didn't pan out. It didn't look as good. You
yeah.
know, and then things died down again, but the hubris was still on the internet. So I still have patients coming asking me about it. Now I know that trials are underway, as you said. I mean, I've got to watch the 60 minute segment, but, the trials are underway. I don't know if we have it at our local VA or not, but I mean, of course I'm excited and intrigued to see how the data comes out, but it hasn't come out yet.
They're very careful to say in that segment, that it's not a cure, that it is a symptomatic treatment, and often can free people up so that they can then engage in talk therapy.
Okay.
Because previously it was just too much to even for that to even make sense to them. So
okay,
yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
it's more like an adjunct. It sounds like an adjunctive treatment as opposed to a standalone cure. Okay,
right.
That's
right.
Interesting. Yeah,
they're being clear about that.
That's good.
Yeah, a couple other items I have on my little list here: virtual reality. I interviewed somebody years ago, Skip Rizzo at mm-hmm. USC, who, and I think he's still doing this work where he puts combat veterans using virtual reality as a kind of exposure therapy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm very interested in psychedelic therapy, which is starting to come around again after, mm-hmm. You know, having been discredited back in the 60s. There's mm-hmm. a whole renaissance of interest in psychedelics. And I believe that some people have had the experience of being freed up from PTSD. I'm not absolutely certain of whether I'm stretching that or not.
I mean, again, you know, I think a lot of what I get concerned about as someone who's a clinician and I also do research is that, you know, differentiating what is tried and tested as being through the hoops, is out there being used by many, many practitioners, versus what's experimental and still in early stage. So,
sure.
You know, I believe there was a trial for ecstasy and PTSD, you know, MDMA, I think sometime
yes.
last year, like
okay.
a pilot. But, you know, as you know, approving any type of pharmaceutical for treatment of a condition, you have to go through many hoops.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And it's not just a matter of if it helps. You know, we need to look at side effect profile. We need to look at, you know, risk-benefit analysis. And in my mind, it's still early days for all of that. I mean, it's happening, but it's still early days.
Yeah.
My biggest fear is that, you know, even if something goes through all the hoops that the FDA requires, oftentimes a medication has to be on the market for a few years before you get a full sense of what the side effects are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's only once it's been rolled out to millions of people and then the data starts coming in. And we've been through many of cycles of that in psychiatry. In the 20 years that I've been a doctor, I've been through many cycles of that where something has been touted with much fanfare only for a few years for us to later for us to realize that, oh my word, this medicine has got horrific side effects.
Yes.
You know? So again, you know, as you might gather, I'm a little on the cautious and the conservative side. And I feel like, you know, when I meet people, they're feeling desperate, right? Of course, they're feeling desperate. When you are suffering mentally, you feel desperate. And you want to hang on to anything that is going to relieve you of your anxiety. And I feel like then things that have this kind of magic bullet quality to them just hold a lot of allure when people are feeling desperate. And I do feel part of my job as the clinician is to kind of be a guide and remind people that, you know, okay, this is what we know works. This is what's tried and tested. This is what has been on the market for years and years and years and years. And you have very little to lose by trying this. And then if these don't work, then let's put our thinking caps on and think about something different. Sometimes people just want to skip right to what sounds most promising.
Right.
You know?
In the book, you warn about the allure of magic bullets. And I underlined that phrase. I think it's such a powerful way to state it, the allure of magic bullets, which is a very human tendency. I mean, I sort of wince when I read that because I recognize that I can be very susceptible to the kind of the kind of hope, you know, that, oh, here's the thing.
Well, good for you. Good for you for being aware of yourself. I mean, and like I say, it's natural. We, you know, a lot of us who are in this work, we want to alleviate suffering. You know, that's why we're here, and we want to help people who are in agony. But too many times over my career, I've seen how these treatments, they overpromise and they underdeliver.
You know,
and then you're kind of left with someone who's so disappointed.
You have a section in your book called The Americanization of Human Suffering. Mm-hmm. Of course, that caught my eye. What are you getting at there?
Well, there is this big raging debate in the world's mental health literature that came up when there was a bunch of world mental health surveys done. I think it was around 2010, where they, in essence, tried to replicate a lot of the epidemiological studies that were done in the 1990s in America and in Europe, where they, you know, they designed these hefty studies with many, many people enrolled because they really wanted to get a sense of, okay, what is the prevalence of, you know, depression, anxiety, substance abuse disorders, PTSD? What is the actual prevalence in low and middle income countries?
Yeah.
Okay. So they designed these surveys, they rolled them out, and lo and behold, what happened? The data on PTSD was coming back as really low, okay? So some countries were reporting rates of PTSD of zero.
Uh-huh.
And some were reporting rates of PTSD of like, you know, 0.5% or 1%. You know, and this is compared to a prevalence of 6 to 8% in European and American and America.
Okay.
European countries and America, okay?
Yeah.
So then there was this, you know, kind of revolt in the scientific community. Well, you know, what's the point of a diagnosis that does not have a worldwide applicability? You know, is PTSD somehow a culture-bound phenomenon that's very American, you know? And then some even went as far to push that argument to say, well, you know what? Rates of trauma exposure in low and middle income countries are the same as in America, or if not higher. Maybe people in low and middle income countries have this kind of paradoxical resiliency. Maybe they're more accepting of trauma, and that's why they don't develop PTSD.
Yeah.
So
one has to wonder. Yeah.
Well, so this argument was put out there. You know, I have to say that I am not in that favor of that argument. In any shape or form, I feel like it's a dangerous argument. I feel like there are many explanations for why the data came back the way it did. And paradoxical resilience is probably last on my list of the explanations. I feel a couple things. First of all, there's probably culture bound syndromes, right? Trauma is probably expressed in different ways in different countries. That I accept. And maybe the way we describe PTSD in America and in Europe doesn't map on that well to other cultures and communities. Right. But that doesn't mean we should throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? It just means we need to evolve our sense of what PTSD is.
Yeah.
So I think that probably explains the discrepancy. The problem is, as soon as you start this rhetoric that PTSD does not exist in our society, doctors will stop looking for it. Research will stop funding it, and it will kind of just slip into the shadows as it's always done. You know, the problem is that oftentimes people who are most impacted by PTSD are women, children, minority groups, marginalized groups. And the reality is that in some parts of the world, these groups do not have a voice. They do not have a platform.
Yes.
They may not feel safe to say, oh, I was traumatized, because the minute you say you're traumatized, you have to allege that there was a perpetrator, you know, certainly in human-made disasters, right? Now, if you don't feel safe doing that for whatever reason, because there's no laws to protect you, or you don't have any socioeconomic clout, well, guess what? It's going to look like there's no PTSD.
Yeah, right.
So I think that the situation is way more complicated, and I'm very perturbed by this argument that low and middle income countries do not have a PTSD problem. I think that's very misleading.
Yeah, excellent cautions, I think. Well, earlier you were going to wax poetic on the prevention of PTSD. So this is your opportunity.
Yeah. So I love thinking about prevention, because I feel like as a frontline clinician, sometimes, you know, we've come to feel that the limits of treatment, you know, and we don't think about prevention enough. Only 5% of U.S. healthcare spending is on prevention, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like in PTSD, there's been a lot that we've learned about prevention. So, for example, first and foremost, you know, obviously, if we can prevent violence, you know, obviously you prevent a lot of PTSD.
Yes.
So any kind of programs, policies, interventions that, you know, aim to prevent things like family violence or sexual violence or mass shootings, they're all really vital. But I think what's changed now in the 21st century compared to previous violence prevention efforts is that now we have the scientific rigor, you know, and we're much better able to, because of advances in kind of statistical tools and the availability of big data, we're much better at finding out what really works and why in violence prevention programs, you know, like what are the secret sauce ingredients. And the advantage of that is then you can scale those programs, you know, and you can implement them in all communities. And that's really what we need, things that are replicable and scalable. So that is what's intriguing nowadays about violence prevention programs, is that rigor. There's also this period of time known as the golden hours.
Yes, right.
You know, that window between trauma exposure and the onset of PTSD, you know, like we were saying earlier, not trauma exposure does not equal PTSD, but some people will develop PTSD.
Yes.
So many people, many scientists and clinicians have thought, well, you know, the golden hours, it might be this chance for medical intervention to set a pathway toward recovery.
Yeah, a critical, you know, period. Yeah.
Yes. And intervening in that golden hours, you know, whether it be with some type of, you know, pharmaceutical manipulation or some type of psychological therapy, you know, could reset the brain toward health.
Yeah.
So a lot of interesting work done there. Again, nothing ready for prime time, but I do feel like in the next 10 years, we'll have a much better idea of what to do there. But, you know, the third form of prevention, which I think is what we're using the most, is this kind of tertiary prevention where, okay, you accept that people have got PTSD, and what you do instead is you re-engineer mental health care so that PTSD care is more accessible, more acceptable, more available to sufferers, so that it doesn't become a chronic problem. You know, the same way with cancer prevention, the same way with heart disease, early intervention is key for PTSD as well.
Yeah, stigma is a big issue as well, isn't it? That people don't seek services, don't self-present because they feel shamed that you know, that their experience is shameful, and they don't want to be tagged as suffering from post-traumatic syndrome.
Particularly
males, but not just males. I'm also thinking of women who've been raped and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel like I'm constantly fighting. You know, there's internal and external barriers to people seeking help, and I think internal barrier stigma is a big one. Also, just the very nature of PTSD, you know, as I was saying earlier, avoidance is one of the symptom clusters. You know, people have literally reworked their life so they don't have to think about the trauma. That's their way of coping.
Yes.
So then obviously the idea of coming to see someone like me is just, it doesn't make any sense to them. You know, so the avoidance and then the mistrustfulness. I think a lot of people with PTSD, especially PTSD because of human-made disasters, they mistrust. They don't trust.
Mm-hmm.
They don't trust organizations. They don't trust doctors, because whenever there's a power differential that's not in the person's favor, I think trust becomes an issue.
Yeah.
And so stigma, mistrust, avoidance, constant barriers to people seeking help. So where do these people show up in the healthcare system? They might not show up in mental health, but they show up in primary care, you know? And so that's one of the early intervention strategies that I talk about in the book, is that, you know, mental health professionals, we need to literally move our practices, you know, which is what I've done in the last 10 years. My practice is now in primary care.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I literally want to go meet people where they're at,
yes,
rather than waiting for them to come see a mental health professional, which 50% of the time is not going to happen.
So when you say you go to primary care, can you expand on that a little bit? Like,
sure, absolutely. So, you know, you think of, you know, your regular doctor's office where you go see your internist or your general practitioner. You know, in the VA over the last 10 years, we've shifted that we have a mental health professional embedded in that clinic too. So, you know, oftentimes there's a full-time psychologist or a social worker in that clinic. And then the way I do it is once a week, I go sit in primary care and I have a psychiatric clinic there. And so, you know, sometimes my colleagues in primary care will be seeing a patient who's come in for an annual physical. And
okay.
it'll become very apparent that, you know, they have untreated PTSD or depression or anxiety. And they'll literally say to the patient, you know what, we have a colleague here who we work with closely, who's a mental health professional. How do you feel about checking in with her today?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, and you're right there on the spot. Yeah, excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. It's something that we haven't discussed, but it's a little bit of the flip side of responding to trauma is resilience and post-traumatic growth,
mm-hmm.
which I think are, there's kind of, they're sort of new in the conversation to my thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as you said, like post-traumatic growth, you know, when we go back to those two populations, the people who are exposed to trauma, some develop PTSD, many will heal naturally with the passage of time and they will be fine. Some people in that latter group will report that they will be beyond fine,
yes,
that they will experience what is known as post-traumatic growth, where, you know, that traumatic experience was this major learning experience for them and they really reevaluated their life's priorities and they really, you know, reevaluated what they wanted from life, and then they kind of lead this enhanced life, you
yes,
know.
Yes.
So there's actually a lot of research being done in post-traumatic growth, and there's actually books written about it. I think I just live in a different world, you know. Obviously, as a psychiatrist and a PTSD specialist, I don't get to meet a lot of people who are lucky enough to have post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
I get to meet that other group of people.
Right.
So resilience has become very important because, and very studied closely, because I think a lot of people have felt, well, if this vast majority of people do okay in the aftermath of trauma, what can we learn from them,
mm-hmm.
and apply to the people who don't do so well?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we know some things about resilience in the aftermath of trauma. I feel like what does not get emphasized enough, though, is how much of your resilience your ability to be resilient after trauma is actually related to your zip code, you know, where you live.
Oh, yeah.
And the resilience of your wider community. I think that gets lost. I think we tend to glorify human beings as being these amazing examples of people who have thrived after adversity, but we don't really pay attention to how much of their ability to thrive was linked to the kind of luck of where they were born.
Yeah.
You know, geography really is kind of destiny. If you live in a resilient community, you are very fortunate.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're probably tapping into a lot of resources in that community, just the home you were raised in, your access to education, your access to money, the fact that you have a platform, the fact you have a voice, you know. And I think if you change the zip code, that resilience may never get a chance to manifest itself. So I feel like moving forward, we've got to focus on ways of leveling the playing field.
How do we
make all communities resilient? You know,
yeah.
So that everybody can be resilient after trauma exposure, as
Amen.
Opposed to, there you go.
That's
my two cents on resilience.
Yeah. Well, I know you've got some thoughts about the Me Too movement, what's going on there, and its relationship to helping survivors of trauma. What can you tell us about that?
So as you kind of mentioned earlier, you know, like rape is the trauma most likely to lead to PTSD, closely followed by like combat exposure and physical assault. But, you know, there's something about rape that is potently traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the United States alone, nearly one in five women has been raped at some point in her life. Obviously, men are victims of rape too, but women are just much more commonly the victims of rape.
Right.
There's something about the crime of rape which historically has carried this stigma, you know, and oftentimes the rape survivor who risks being shamed is forced into silence. But there's something about that silence that just bolsters rape's power to wreak havoc on the life of a survivor.
Yes.
Sometimes when the survivor speaks up, they face what we call secondary injuries from those who subtly or not so subtly blame her. And, you know, we know that post-trauma social support is really powerful in helping survivors heal, especially for women. There's something about the way women are either wired or the way they are socialized, that social support is really important for them. And if they're denied that support, the consequences are devastating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if this Me Too movement that has been going on for at least 2 years now, if not longer, if that means less stigma surrounding rape, if that means less secondary injuries for survivors, you know, who speak up,
yes.
And if it means more social support for survivors, then I think that can only mean reduced rates of PTSD in the future, you know?
That will be interesting to research at some point.
Yes.
It's been around long enough.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to have our listeners be aware of?
I feel like we covered so much. There's so much more. This is kind of never ending. But I feel like we hit a lot of the high points in our conversation.
Well, good. Well, Dr. Shelley Jane, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. The pleasure was absolutely mine.
My guest, Shelley Jane, MD, Stanford psychiatrist and author of the remarkable 2019 book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing, from the front lines of PTSD science, is in the unusual position of being both a leading-edge researcher and a clinician on the front lines. Her role as medical director for integrated care at the VA Palo Alto healthcare system gives her a unique vantage point, in as much as her VA hospital is a node within the Veterans Administration that concentrates on PTSD research and treatment. In the interview, we discuss an experimental treatment approach I had just learned about, stellate ganglion block, or SGB. This technique, which is in human trials, is only offered at 12 VA centers. I learned about it on the very day of our interview, where it was profiled on the popular long-running U.S. television magazine show 60 Minutes. I'm realizing that the technique needs a bit more explanation than we gave it in the interview. It involves injecting an anesthetic into the patient's neck at a point near the spine where a nerve complex, the stellate ganglion, can be accessed. An injection of anesthetic into this nerve bundle can help relieve pain in the head, neck, upper arm, and upper chest. It also can help increase circulation and blood supply to the arm. In the 60 Minutes segment, the impact on several veterans they interviewed before and after the process was very dramatic. Within 5 to 15 minutes, the mood of these veterans visibly shifted from tense, pained, and hypervigilant to relaxed, smiling, and optimistic. While it looked quite miraculous, again, the show did caution that this treatment is still in the experimental phase and is only being offered in 12 VA facilities. They also stipulated that it is not a cure and that the relief may only last for a few months to maybe as long as a year. However, another important finding is that for at least some veterans, it makes them more willing to follow up with talk therapy. Now, to her credit, Dr. Jane does discuss the SGB therapy in her book. However, that discussion is in her chapter warning about the, quotes, allure of magic bullets for treating PTSD. I think to some degree her caution was in response to earlier overly enthusiastic reports proclaiming SGB as a cure. Something else Dr. Jane reveals in her book that I didn't delve into during our interview is her own history of trauma, a kind of generational trauma going back to the partitioning of India and Pakistan in 1947. She writes that in the ensuing upheaval, up to 14 million people were forced to leave their ancestral homelands. Her father was only 10 years old when he was orphaned and forced to leave Pakistan and live in India. 20 years later, he would move to England, where today's guest was born and raised. Even though she personally had not lived through the partition, she notes that her father seemed permanently scarred by it. She also reports that her own brown skin and foreign name made her acutely aware of being a second-class citizen in England. These events ultimately helped to shape her career to one of caring for those suffering from trauma. You won't find a more authoritative book on PTSD than Dr. Shelley Jane's, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. And by the way, the spelling of Dr. Jane's name is, her first name is S-H-A-I-L-I, and Jane is spelled J-A-I-N.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Russell from New South Wales, Australia. You asked me to put together just a quick note to say why I was happy to support Shrink Wrap Radio. I discovered these podcasts totally by accident a few months ago and been systematically working my way through them. I was looking for ways to increase my educational experience and content whilst travelling to and from work, and stumbled upon your podcast, yeah, quite by chance. I've been blown away by the breadth and sophistication and the richness of the educational resource that you've got going there, Dave, and really is a tribute to your hard work and dedication. I think, like someone else may have said in the past on one of your previous podcasts, for me, the thought of you not doing this work through financial constraints was, I guess, a big motivator for me to put my hand in my pocket. So keep up the good work, Dave. It's brilliant.
Thank you, Russell, there in New South Wales. Thank you for your contribution and for encouraging others to support Shrink Wrap Radio. Last week, I mentioned that I heard from blogger Anuj Agarwal that he's listed Shrink Wrap Radio as one of the top 15 psychology podcasts. I've put the link to his list of the top 15 psychology podcasts on the In the Media tab on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And on the same In the Media page, you can read about Jane Hart, who was a guest on the show back on episode number 531, which was titled My Multiples, Living with Dissociative Identity Disorder. And she is starring in a 6-part A&E series on television about her struggles with this disorder. I discovered this by chance when a Google tool I use notified me that an online story mentioned Shrink Wrap Radio. Here's part of what that notice said. Quote, in June 2016, Jane Hart wrote an article sharing her knowledge of dissociative identity disorder and her personal struggle, which led to a speaking opportunity on a well-known psychology podcast, Shrink Wrap Radio. This opportunity led to a life-changing journey, the opportunity to chronicle her life living with DID on the new docu-series titled Many Sides of Jane, airing on A&E. Under the guidance of her therapist, Jane currently identified over 9 distinct identities, or parts as Jane refers to them, and she's working to unlock the mysteries surrounding her trauma and to find internal harmony between her many sides. Upon agreeing to participate in the Rare and Raw series, Jane made a promise to herself to be 100% open, real, and honest, letting the world see that those suffering from DID still have the same hopes and dreams as everyone else. Jane's goal in opening her life to the cameras is not only to erase the misconceptions about this highly stigmatized disorder, but to also normalize mental illness and to spread the truth about the silent epidemic of child abuse and its lasting effects on the human brain. Jane feels there is power in sharing her story, and it is her mission to help others realize mental health is just as important as physical health. Those suffering from DID are special, smart, and unique. They deserve compassion, kindness, and understanding. End quote. So I was able to find this series on A&E TV channel. It's on demand. My service provider is Comcast. So I encourage you to hunt for it. You'll find it most enlightening. So far I've watched 2 half-hour episodes. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again for today. Thanks to today's guest, psychiatrist Shelley Jane, discussing her 2019 book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. Next week, I'll be speaking with Jungian Robert D. Romanishin about his very fascinating 2019 book, Victor Frankenstein, The Monster and the Shadow of Technology. It's an archetypal look at the underbelly of our increasingly technological society through the cautionary story of the Frankenstein monster. You definitely don't want to miss this one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.